Hi, everybody. Well, hi, all of you who are still here. I think the band is on a trip or something like that, too. Several other guys are already out. There's actually a long and illustrious tradition of a drop-off in class attendance immediately after the second midterm. So, you know, you may look around the room and hear crickets because it feels like half of you are here. Well, actually, less than half of you are technically here, probably, if you run the count. But that's why I post all the class audio, and that's why I post all the class slides, so that folks like the band people who are on a trip can keep up with things. I'm in the near the end. I'm not quite in the middle. I'm close to the end of grading the second midterms. It's not quite done yet, but as is usually the tradition, I'll mail everybody information along with returning the tests on Wednesday. So happy birthday to Anton van Leeuwenhoek. If you know you're Danish, I guess, or Dutch, I can never keep those straight. You can pronounce his name properly. He was famous for discovering animalcules, basically bacteria, several hundred years ago in an improvised microscope. Drake, who was one of my mother's favorite rap artists. Yes, my late mother was a big, big rap fan, believe it or not. Kevin Kline, famous actor. Wilhelm Weber, you'll learn more about him next semester. He is one of the famous physicists responsible for the torture of electricity and magnetism that you'll have to suffer through. Degenes is our Nobel Prize winning physicist for today. So won the Nobel in 91 and died soon afterwards. Happy United Nations Day and National Bologna Day. Not like they're actually connected or correlated. So a few announcements. So I'll have midterms to return on Wednesday. That includes, if you still haven't picked up midterm one, I'll have those in the bag as well. I'll go over some common misconceptions. There were a lot of people who looked at the first exam or the sample exam I gave you and immediately tried to basically just use those equations on the problems of this exam rather than going back to first principles. It was a little bit odd and has me questioning, you know, my approach to giving you access to such information. But I'll go over some misconceptions at least. Overall, there are lots of people who did well, lots of people who didn't do so well. At this point in the semester, it's really important for you to know where you stand. I think a lot of you do, a lot of you may not. So what I do at this point in the semester, having two midterms in the can and half of the semester's homework or close to it, is I give you a full breakdown of your grade, a class ranking, where you are relative to everybody else in the class, and an estimated letter grade. And that should give you enough information to decide well in time, well in advance of the drop deadline of November 8th, vote early, vote often, and maybe withdraw from physics, if you need to drop. So there is no harm in dropping. Some of the best people I know have dropped and come back again and done better later on when they have, for example, more math in their bags. Halloween is next Monday, so I'll bring some candy. Yay, and I might dress up. Who knows? I like Halloween. I like giving out candy and dressing up and terrorizing the neighborhood youth, including all of you, apparently, who I have already been terrorizing. In 2 weeks, I will be out of town for a week. Dr. Todd goes to Vancouver. I am at a meeting with an international collaboration up there all week. There's no class that Wednesday. I'll post notes and maybe even post audio from Vancouver. But Monday, there will be a lecture. Balsha Terzic, one of my good friends from Jefferson Lab, who's now a professor here at least, has graciously agreed to sub in for me on that Monday. And Balsha is younger than I am, more energetic than I am, better looking than I am, everything. So at least enjoy him while you got him. Any questions on this stuff so far? Okay. So at this point in the semester, we've gone through close to half of the material of the entire semester. And the new material that we're about to cover takes a little while because it's all about rotational motion. Today is mostly reiterating and reintroducing terms, emphasizing some concepts. I'll work through some example problems, like it or not, and this is just the way the book is written, and I'm trying to follow the narrative arc of the book. If it were completely up to me, I would be teaching the stuff that I'm teaching today earlier in the semester, because you're going to recognize it's back to kinematics again, okay? And in fact, angular kinematics is just like linear kinematics, except everything is divided by the radius of the circle that you're turning on. And I'm going to emphasize that again and again. It's just like linear kinematics, except now it's angular kinematics. I would normally teach them all together, except the book puts them in Chapter 8, so we're stuck here now. Okay? So this week, and actually probably going into next week as well, we'll go in through all of this rotational motion, talking about the rotational motion of rigid bodies. For at the beginning, at least, it'll be things turning on circles. Later on, it'll actually be talking about how more complicated bodies turn and how they resist that, how there's an analog for mass and linear motion called moment of inertia in rotational motion, which is how something resists turning force or torque, and we'll get into torque. We'll talk about gyroscopes. Gyroscopes are about as magic as it gets in first year mechanical physics, in the sense of you need to actually have a good three-dimensional vision of what's going on. And even I, as a 50-year-old PhD physicist teaching this course, spin a gyroscope and hold it up where somebody sits on a chair and does conservation of angular momentum, and it feels a little bit like magic to me. And I encourage you to ask questions, because it is not obvious, and the more you question it, probably the more tangled up I'll get trying to explain it. But I'm hoping someday I'll have that insight that lets me really say, this is why a gyroscope works this way. And, you know, gyroscopes are very, very common. I mean, right down to your cell phones, right? There are nanotech gyroscopes, essentially, in your cell phones as well. So, and then we'll combine linear and angular motion. We'll get to, okay, the block isn't sliding down the plane, but a ball is rolling down the plane. Or a sphere is rolling down the plane. Or a cylinder is rolling down the plane. How are those different? How are those the same? You actually have all the tools to do hard problems. And by hard problems, I mean problems like, put a billiard ball on a table. And where do I hit that billiard ball such that it exactly rolls and doesn't slip backward and doesn't slip forward? Okay? That's a reasonably hard problem, it turns out. If you hit it too high, clearly you're going to hit it so that it spins and slips backwards. If you hit it too low, clearly it's going to backspin and backspin underneath. So somewhere in between, there's got to be a perfect spot where you can hit it just right, where it gets just enough turn and just enough spin to not slip. Where is that? We'll get to that problem as a problem in class. That is way harder than any homework you'll have. Yeah.
Are you assuming there's no friction at the table?
No, you need friction. Oh. If there's no friction, it always slips.
Right. Well, what I mean is, a lot of people in school have this problem that when they want to try to backspin across the table, the friction at the table gives it a forward rotation.
Yep. Absolutely. Yeah. And there are different, you know, some scuffed up tables have more friction than others too.
Yeah.
But we'll assume an idealized case. But you absolutely need the friction. Just like you absolutely need the friction if you're skidding out in a car, for example, and then starting to go. You have both slipping, you know, kinetic and static, friction involved in a problem like that along with rotational motion. So we can complicate things and bring in almost everything that we've learned so far. Yeah, it's a lot of stuff, but that's exactly what physics is incorporating this body of knowledge into more and more complicated and, frankly, realistic problems. So going back to one-dimensional kinematics, right? You thought you could put this behind you at the first exam. Sorry, you can't. Remember, velocity is defined as how position changes with time, and truly, actually, it's a vector, right? Position in three dimensions changes with time. Acceleration is how velocity changes with time as well. Those are definitions, just plain definitions. And then we had a couple of equations that come out of that, right? Okay, if we take acceleration to be constant, we can actually integrate these equations and end up with an equation that shows you how position changes with time. That was what I called back in those days the movie equation, because you start off with a certain initial set of conditions and a certain acceleration, and you run a timer and you watch how things go. And then this velocity equation, how velocity changes with time, is really just the definition of acceleration, right? If you move this dt over and take those things as deltas, this is acceleration times the change in time is equal to the change in velocity, right? So those things all extend straight from the definitions. And then rotational motion, at least early on, you were introduced to one simple rotational motion thing, and that's centripetal acceleration for something going around in a circle. So let's remind ourselves what the coordinate system is. And the coordinate system I covered once before briefly, but we're going to use it a lot more now. And that is, everything is in angles, angular velocity, angular acceleration, angular position. And with that, you need an angular coordinate system and an angular set of units. And the standard set of units that you use for everything is radians. Convert everything to radians. Put your calculators in radians. Use radians from here on out. Your oceanographers and engineers and physicists, your scientists, and you're going to be scientists. Degrees are handy because that's what you've been taught your entire life. But radians are truly the unit that's useful. And I'll explain why in a sec. I mean, really, radians are kind of deeply physical. Well, degrees are artificial. They're man-made.
Degrees are like radians, so require calculus.
Well, there's it depends. If you express everything in pi, you can manipulate radians too, right? So sometimes, exactly. So 360 degrees, right, the full circle is 2 pi radians. And the circumference of a circle is 2 pi r, and that's deeply connected. 2 pi r, 2 pi radians, 360 degrees. And you define x0, or theta equals 0 radians, however you like. The physics shouldn't matter about your frame of reference. So, but it's easy enough to convert radians to degrees, or degrees to radians. Just multiply by the ratio of 1, right? 2 pi radians over 360 degrees, or vice versa, like that example down on the bottom. Or just type it into Google and say, 360 degrees in radians, Google, click, and it'll give it to you. Of course, it'll give it to you without the pi. It'll probably tell you it's 6.2832 blah blah, but that's fine. So why are radians so deeply fundamentally important? And that is because there is one equation that kind of all of angular kinematics and the relationship between angular kinematics and linear kinematics stems from, and that is distance around the edge of a circle. what's called an arc distance or something like that, that S in this equation is equal to R times theta if theta is written in radians, right? So if you got a 1 meter radius circle and you're going around the edge of that circle, how far did you go? 2 pi meters, right? Which is 2 pi in radians, theta, times that radius. So this is the, you know, fundamental equation that connects all of linear kinematics, all of angular kinematics. And now I've got real distances. S is a real distance in meters. R is a real distance in meters. Theta is in radians. And now since S and R are both in meters, you can kind of also tell that radians, this is something that gets some people, radians is a little bit of a fake unit, right? Radians is not really a unit. It's kind of unitless, actually, because both S and R here are in meters. And so multiplying by radians doesn't change your units at all. So the radians kind of just disappears quietly. So degrees do carry units. Radians carry units. But there's radians. I always emphasize radians. An angle is really like a ratio of two sides of a triangle, right? And a ratio of two sides of a triangle cancels out the units as well. So it's no surprise that there should be some way of expressing angles that is really, truly, fundamentally unitless, that has a deep connection to how angles are defined, and that is as ratios of things. Even the Greeks knew this. The Greeks did all of their triangle math through ratios of sides. So this equation only works if theta is in radians, of course, but once it does, it works for everything. But now I've got this great thing, right? Because I've got a distance, S, and I've got an angle, theta. So, well, I defined linear velocities as derivative of distance with time. So now I can take a derivative of this thing on both sides. If the radius isn't changing, if I'm going in a constant radius, now I can say the derivative of S with respect to time, a linear velocity, is R times the derivative of theta with respect to time, which is an angular velocity. And I can take another derivative and say the angular acceleration is like that, related to the linear acceleration. So everything stems from this one equation and that one realization of how you convert between angles and position. So I can define kind of angular velocity as how that angle changes with time for something that's rotating. And this is just like all of linear kinematics with constant acceleration. All of this stuff, all of angular kinematics that you're about to learn is constant angular acceleration, kind of, pretty much, and now constant radius. Right? If something is banking around and changing radius, you can look locally at every given little point if something skids around. Right? If let's say we break the assumption of constant radius, and now I've got something going around. You know, clearly that's not the arc of a circle. But I can take every little bit here and kind of draw roughly very close to an arc of a circle. And it's different arcs with different radii. That's R2, R1, etc. If I treat everything locally enough, it has close enough to constant curvature that I can use angular kinematic equations. And this is the reason why you use even constant acceleration as the assumption in linear kinematics, is because in any little given point of time, you can kind of assume, even if acceleration is changing all the time, for every little slice of time, acceleration is close to the same. Well, here, for every little slice of time, if I have radius about constant for this slice, I can write some equation here that gets me from here to there. Then I can write another equation with another radius, maybe a slightly bigger radius, that gets me from there to there with a different radius, and so on and so forth. So just because the equations don't hold globally doesn't mean that you can't write a little computer program or do some little analysis that breaks the problem into small enough steps that you can use all of the techniques you're given. This is there I am waving my hands again. This is why Newton was so brilliant, is because he saw this even at a time when people barely knew about motion and how to describe motion. He knew that writing F equals ma, even when acceleration was not necessarily constant all the time, was good enough, because he also invented calculus, and in calculus you can break things down into microscopic little steps. So acceleration, angular acceleration, just derivative of theta with respect to time, just like your angular velocity, just like linear velocity is derivative of position with respect to time. Okay? And just like you have S equals R theta, now if I take a derivative on both sides, the derivative of S with respect to time is velocity. Derivative of theta with respect to time is that nice little omega. And we use Greek letters for all the angular stuff, because we ran out of normal, regular Arabic letters. So again, it's only true if everything is in radians. But once it's in radians, the relationship between linear and angular velocity is this equation. And it stems straight from the first one. So if I've got, let's say, okay, I'm old. I still do have, in fact, 45 RPM records. And you put a record on the turntable, or you put something turning around, it's turning at a constant angular velocity everywhere, right? 33 and a third, or 45 RPM, revolutions per minute. But everywhere along the radius, you're moving at a different linear speed. And the further out you are, the larger your radius is on this equation for a constant angular velocity. The larger your radius, the larger your actual linear velocity. Those of you that like to go to the amusement park and ride the spinny rides, you know that, okay, if you're riding a spinny ride much further out than closer in, you get more centripetal acceleration, you get more linear velocity as well. So far, so good. Yeah, what's up, Mackenzie? Oh, you mean between these two?
Which one? Line, like versus average.
Oh, bar.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So the bar is. The bar is mathematical notation that just means a gross average rather than a local calculation, like a real derivative. So, for example, in the old linear kinematics problems, people would say, I went from this location to 2 miles from here in half an hour. What was my average speed? Well, my average speed was the distance divided by total distance divided by total time. That's what that is. It's a gross average. It doesn't say anything about did I speed up or slow down anywhere in between. My gross average speed, just like here, that's a gross average angular velocity. So it's what was my, overall, what did the average have to be getting from one place to another? So there's when we did angular stuff before, I pulled up a nice little pet app called Ladybug Revolution that actually pointed out velocity vectors going around the turntable, centripetal acceleration vectors pointing in towards the center of a turntable. And so you can put little bugs on this turntable and spin it around, and you can't spin it around fast enough to squash them. I've tried. But you can at least spin it around and see how the different terms, how linear and angular acceleration and all of these different things relate. So you can even pull this up and type in an angular velocity and see where these guys go. So let's do that real quick. I think I have it up. So there is an initial angle of 2, and here notice that it actually is reporting the angles in degrees. I'm going to change the angles to radians instead, because we always work in radians. And let's say, let's turn this thing now. How big is 1 radian? 1 radian is that big. Okay. From going from 0 radians to 1 radians, I happen to know that 1 radian, kind of, you get used to the idea that 1 radian is actually about 53 degrees or something like that, right? I can 57. There you go. 1 radian is 57.3 degrees. And now we can turn on some speed and actually have this guy spin around and move at an angular velocity of 1 radian per second, or 10 radians per second, or however fast it is, okay? That red line that goes through the center that's way off the screen is actually the angular, is actually the centripetal acceleration acting on the ladybug. If I put it at 3, you can see that the centripetal acceleration is reasonable there. You can see his position over time is actually executing kind of a sine wave. His X position and Y position go like a sine and a cosine. When we get to simple harmonic motion, this will come back again. And simple harmonic motion is actually sometimes easiest to describe as just a projection of circular motion. But you can take all these little plots, you can show your little ladybug graph and the beetle graph somewhere in here. As I move my beetle around, his velocity and acceleration move until I drop him on that rotating thing as well. It may seem like, you know, this is a toy. One of the things that the really clever students in this class do is that they can pull up this while they're doing their homework, or even during an exam, for example, right? And you can double check. Because now, let's say you've got a problem, and the problem says, oh, something's turning at this angular velocity with this particular radius. You can plug it into one of these simulations and get the simulated answer out and check it against your answer. Don't just write down the answer from the simulation and box it. I'm not going to give you credit because you need to show your work. But at least you can double check your calculations against a simulation that seems to do something when you put one of these little bugs on the edge of this thing and you can move things around. So far, so good. So that's Ladybug Revolution. That's one of these simple little applets, just like the applet that did projectile motion for us and we get through the car. Okay, this is an applet that now does simulated rotational motion. And you can add in some angular acceleration and go from there. So work out, you know, over a couple minutes or something like that. I've got my 45 RPM, right? And they are, in fact, 7 inches. This is not one of mine, but I pulled out one of mine and measured it. So it's 7 inches in diameter. goes at 45 revolutions per minute, which is 45 times 2 pi radians per minute, which is 45 times 2 pi times 60 radians per second. So, and now the question is, how fast is the edge of this thing moving in inches per second? I'll work it out while you're working it out on the board, and then we can compare numbers. And then, so if a bug sits on the edge, how many G's does he feel? Is it really, you know, is this like a bug ride at the amusement park up at Busch Gardens or something like that, where the bug is going to be able to sit up against the wall and have the floor drop out? So calculate those real quick, and we'll come back in a couple minutes and see what numbers we get. And I'm going to do it with you, assuming I know how to do it. Okay, so what's his velocity on his edge? So he's going at 45 revolutions RPM, revolutions per minute, multiplied by 2 pi radians per revolution, and the revs cancel out. Multiplied by a minute per 60 seconds, and the minutes cancel out. So he ends up with that angular velocity. 3 pi over 2 radians per second, which feels about right. He's going a little bit more than a radian, more than a radian per second as he spins around on my turntable. No. The diameter was 7 inches. Hey, you got it. And that's going to be a getcha everywhere unless you pay attention. 7-inch diameter, 3.5-inch radius. Right? So if the radius is 3.5 inches, use that in there, omega times r. That was omega. The radius is 3.5 inches, so you get that. And then the acceleration is v squared over r. That's the centripetal acceleration that the bug has to feel to keep on clinging on, keep on hanging on around the edge. And 7.9 inches per second, we go the miracle that Google is and say, okay, Google, what's 7.9? Whoops, there's a pi in there. There's pi squared in there. Right, the pi came from the 2 pi radians. It ended up in there. Should end up in there. So that is 5. Okay. Squared divided by 3.5 is 77.7. Inches per second squared, and in G's, right? So that's inches.
You added a pi right there.
You
added a pi right there, but under the inches, it's small.
Where was that? Oh, I added a pi in here, yeah. Right, 5.2, that pi belongs in there. That pi came from here. Right, 3 times 3.5 is 10.5 divided by 2 is 5.25. But the pi had to come over. And the pi ended up in here. That's a pi. Yep. So, and there's a, so that's 77.7 inches per second squared. Divided by 9.8 meters per second squared is 0.2. Not a ton. Probably enough to hold on against. But 0.2 g's is still a pretty good acceleration, right? It's not 10 g's like a fighter pilot. It's not going to rip your aorta off your heart or anything like that. But it is certainly substantial. It's enough to feel. It's enough to feel and get a good ride out of. Yeah, pretty much. Right, 0.7 out of 380, or 77 out of 384, right? Is about a fifth, so that's about right. So that's angular velocity. That's just converting things between each other. And now you've got angular acceleration to deal with as well. And just like angular velocity was back there, where you've got average and instantaneous angular velocity, you're going to have average and instantaneous angular acceleration. Derivative, how does the angular velocity change with time? And this is also related to tangential or linear acceleration, same exact way. Just multiply by a radius. So So radians per second squared versus meters per second squared. No surprise, the units work out where you just multiply by a length scale. And the length scale in this particular problem is the radius for all circular motion problems. So something spinning up, something spinning down. If you spin something up like a drill and you get it up to a final velocity, okay, that means you're accelerating it. And that means you're going to need to apply a turning force, and we'll get to torque later on. Just like you apply a linear force, like gravity, to accelerate something linearly. And now you still have that centripetal radial acceleration as well. Right? These two are two different things. And this is probably, if there's anything on this slide to point out, all the rest of it is easy to derive. But the critical thing is, there are two accelerations acting on an object that's going around the circle. One acceleration is pushing them towards the center of the circle, and that's the centripetal acceleration. Even at constant velocity going around that circle, that acceleration is there. But now, if the circle is spinning up or spinning down, if it's accelerating, right, angularly, if it's spinning up or spinning down, you have an extra acceleration making you go around the circle faster or slower, right? And those two accelerations are both accelerations. They're pointed perpendicular to each other. One is around the circle, one is towards the center of the circle. But they're both, you know, that's two vectors, that's two components, and you can get a net acceleration of the two that ends up pointing in some funny direction in between, because those two components are two components of the total acceleration that object is experiencing. That's tricky, but that's just how it is. And it starts to get you into the mindset that, oh my God, right, rotational motion problems end up being intrinsically two-dimensional at the very least, and actually, once we get into things in a little bit, it'll actually end up being intrinsically three-dimensional. So here's an emphasized version of that picture. Right, I've got something going around a curve, and it's accelerating two different ways. Going around the curve, so you got to be accelerating towards the center to go around the curve. You got to have the centripetal acceleration. And the speed going around that constant curvature is faster, so you got some tangential acceleration as well. So the net acceleration here for this particular picture, for this object, if he's accelerating around in this spin, and he's going around in a circle, then that acceleration is really practically pointing straight to the left. Vectors. All about the vectors, all about the components. And just like ramp problems, the natural components are perpendicular to the plane and parallel to the plane. In circular motion problems, the natural components are always pointing towards the center of the circle, and then tangential around the circle. Yeah. Yeah, and then adding the two vectors together. I'm treating those both as kind of x and y components when finding the result. So just like I said, I mean, the natural coordinate system is radial and tangential towards the center of the circle and tangential around the circle. This is a coordinate system I am very, very used to, because a lot of big particle accelerators look like big circular things that subatomic particles are going around and in circles just like this. So I use magnets and big RF cavity things to make subatomic particles essentially do this kind of motion. So so some simple questions and simple applications that you experience in everyday life, right? If you have a bicycle, and I've got a bicycle at home, and normally the pedal sprocket has a larger radius than the drive sprocket and the wheel, on the rear wheel of the bike, because you want to gear down, you want to apply larger leverage in the front to get power in the back, and we'll get to all of that in a little bit. But the chain is the same chain everywhere. It's just like a rope, just like a cable, whatever it is, and all the various problems where we have two masses stuck together over a wheel. So now this constant linear velocity is everywhere. The chain is moving at the same velocity, linear velocity, around these guys. So is the angular velocity of this chain larger in the front or the back? Is the angular velocity larger in the front or the back? Right? So you've got this, and you've got this, and you've got the two, and there's a velocity of the chain, okay, and you've got R1, you've got R2, and you've got D2 over here. Remember, linear velocity is equal to angular velocity times R, just like linear position was equal to theta times R. I just took a derivative of both sides to get to this. So here, let's say I got the same velocity as omega 1 times R1, and the same velocity as omega 2 times R2. When I'm going around here at omega 1, I'm going around here at omega 2. Okay? So these two guys are equal. And another way of looking at this is I can move these over and say R1 over R2 is equal to omega 2 over omega 1. Whoops. Omega 1. So if R1 is bigger than R2, then omega 2 better be bigger than omega 1 by the same ratio. So the smaller one goes angularly faster, which is exactly how you get the gearing of driving your bike. You turn your front gear once and you drive your back tire around two or three times. Which makes sense, right? You turn this once, and gosh, you drove a lot of the chain around that big gear. That lot of the chain has to make this guy turn several times to go the same distance. And that little gear is attached to a big tire that also rotates like that. One crank of your pedals makes the back wheel go around several times. That's exactly why, you know, bicycles are designed that way. Are there questions about this? Now, I also ask about the angular acceleration, and gosh, just like this and this are the same thing, linear acceleration is equal to angular acceleration times R. Same thing. So R1, you know, this ends up implying that R1 over R2, and the exact same logic, is equal to the angular acceleration 2 over the angular acceleration 1. Using the exact same logic of the same linear acceleration going through that line. This is a machine, and so for engineers, it's important to, you know, understand gearing, right? And this is how gearing works in a and a machine. So if I accelerate my front wheel here, I actually get a lot of leverage and accelerate the back a lot further too, a lot faster. Larger angular acceleration in the back for a larger ratio of those two gears. And I'll add that picture to the class. So now with that, okay, so we've defined angular position related, linearly related, just divide by the radius to get to angular position. We've defined angular velocity linearly with angular velocity, just divide by the radius again. Same with the acceleration. I can take all the kinematic equations that I had for one-dimensional motion, and I can now write down almost immediately off the top of my head what those equations look like for angular stuff, because I just divide by r everywhere. And all of a sudden, dividing by r everywhere puts r's into a's and r's into x's and r's into b's, and I get angular terms, angular equations that look almost exactly the same, except with funny symbols, as their corresponding linear equation brethren. That's it. That's kind of all there is to it. If you knew linear kinematics, oh God, I have to remember linear kinematics again. Don't worry, I'll give you the formulas. But it's important to get a gut feeling that those are connected just by dividing by the radius. That also means that if you're trying to make something go around something of zero radius, you're going to have a little problem on your hands. Just a little one. So let's work through some example problems. Now that we've got all that under our belts, let's work through, I've got a couple of problems, some of which I worked through and some of which I didn't, in the slides. So I take my RPM, my 45 RPM record, and I throw it on my turntable. And I accidentally have the thing set at 33 and a third RPMs, which is fine. And I turn things on, and it spins up in 2 seconds. So what's the average angular acceleration? It goes from 0 radians per second all the way up to 33 and a third revolutions per minute. Okay, I need to convert that, just like I did in the example board over here, to radians per second, because those are the standard units. The initial and final angular velocity. So what's the average angular acceleration? It's just how the angular velocity changed over the given time, 2 seconds. So it went from 0 to 3.46 radians per second in 2 seconds. That's the angular acceleration. That's it. Yes, funny units. Get used to them. You'll be seeing a lot of them over the next week. And frankly, for mechies and engineers that build lots of things, you got lots of gears and turny things. This is, relevant to your future. Any questions about this one? This one is not quite plug and chug, but it's damn close. Just because it's small. I should have put the 0.3 in there. Yeah, laziness. Exactly. There is a little bit harder of a problem, but again, very similar to kinematics that we've already seen in the past, linear kinematics, right? So you start a fan at rest, you're turning something on, and it spins up over 5 seconds and hits 60 radians per second. So that is very similar to the previous problem. I turned something on and it spun up to a final angular velocity. So I can figure out the average angular acceleration, just the change in angular velocity over time. That's it. But now the question is, how many revolutions does the fan make while accelerating? Now that's a little bit harder, and it may feel like, gosh, that's even kind of hard, because the thing is spinning up, and so the amount of angle it's covering per unit time is not constant. But the average angular acceleration is constant. This is like a ball being thrown up in the air. Constant acceleration, except now it's a fan being spun up with constant acceleration again. And you can use a movie equation, right? You can say, just like the total change in position is the initial velocity times time plus 1/2 at squared, exactly the same thing, constant acceleration. You know the time, you know the initial position. You can use the movie equation and just plug the numbers in. And even easier, the initial velocity, the initial angular velocity was zero. So you take that average acceleration, multiply it by the time squared, and that's how far the fan went as it spun up, 150 radians. And usually, I mean, since it's more physical, you convert something like revolutions. Just because, like, oh, it took almost 24 revolutions to spin up. That's a useful calculation if you're an engineer. You got this thing, this fan turning on. How long does it take to get up to speed? And how far does it go as it's getting up to speed? Maybe I'm worried about axle wear or friction or some other things like that. Now, given these assumptions, you can do those sorts of calculations. In the, I'm going to assign more homework based on all of this stuff that's going to be due next Wednesday, since homeworks are usually due on Wednesday. What I'm going to start trying to do in class is I actually brought the textbook with me, and I'll start bringing the textbook with me, and I'll start doing some problems from the textbook that are similar to the homework so that you're getting exact analogs to the homework in the text. Yes, Mikhail.
What's the average?
It should be 12 radians per second squared. Is the, yep. Another lazy point, thank you. The units should work out, an acceleration should be radians per second squared. Absolutely. Because it's a second derivative with respect to time. Let's work out one other example problem from the text and then take a break real quick. This is example problem 3. This is from the book now, so this is similar to the homework you'll get. And this is problem 9.13. So this is item 3. This is problem 9.13 from the book. And that is, I've got a turntable rotating with a constant angular acceleration. Alpha equals 2.25. radians per second squared. And after 4 seconds, it is rotated through an angle 4.00 seconds, and the delta theta is equal to 30 radians. And what I want to find is, what was the angular velocity of the wheel at the beginning? Of that 4 second interval. So I wrote down the relevant stuff here. And I've got this thing spinning up. at a given angular acceleration and a given amount of time. The total delta theta is 30 radians. So I have time. Remember, I can even use equations, right? Like delta omega is equal to alpha times t. Right? Delta theta is equal to omega 0 t plus 1 half alpha t squared. And omega squared is equal to omega 0 squared plus 2 alpha delta theta. Those are the corresponding analogs to the linear kinematics equations that we used to have before. They give me time, so you know that equation. I probably am not going to use that equation, or am I? I guess I can. But here, delta theta is 30 radians. I know alpha, I know t, I don't know omega naught. I'll probably use this. Right, delta theta is equal to omega 0 t plus 1 half at alpha t squared. And that means that omega naught is equal to delta theta over t minus 1 half alpha t. Radians divided by 4 seconds. Right, 30 over 4 is 7.5. This is 2, times that guy is 4.5 seconds cancel out, so I get 3. Again, the mechanisms are exactly the same as the old linear kinematics stuff, except now you're doing it all with angular terms and angular kinematics instead. Yes, Chris? I divide it through by this time here.
Oh.
Right? And thankfully so, because the units work out. Going from there to there, I divided through by time and subtracted out. So, and that feels comfortably enough like a round number that's probably correct. Let's take a 10-minute break, come back the quarter after, and we'll go over another problem or two and maybe start touching on torque and Newton's laws as they apply to rotational motion. So changing the materials change this more than the
second row?
So this depends on the materials.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Okay, so I would fill all the information right here.
So what I would do, so the thing I thought of is, you know, look up a table. Right. You'll probably see that it goes from some of that point of the line up to, you know, some kind of gate. This is a big thing. So changing the materials can have a lot more of that ice versus sandpaper versus did you change the material? So that really sounds like it's big. It wouldn't say that's changing the material. That's changing the material. Did you change the material?
Yeah.
Did you want to change the
material? Yeah, yeah. Well, I really, but I was just
kind of getting the
volume.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And then, so that's all you need to say. Yeah, no, it's fine. It's again one of those things where it's a little bit, you know, it's not obvious. Sure, what's up?
So, with all of my problems, I've been writing them down in my notebook and the rest of like my notes and stuff.
Okay.
Ask for a journal.
Yeah.
Should I rip off those questions?
You can rip them out, you can photocopy them, you can take a photo and turn in the, you know, photos or something like that. I mean, any way that we can just, you know, have a look at it. And we might be able to turn it around very quickly.
Oh, okay. Or
if you
just get
around one day. Yeah, exactly. I mean, that would be great because we're it really is the process of creating each notebook is literally a kind of process.
Okay.
Because we got 7 or 6 days to do this.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure.
Also,
and I know that you want it back because, I mean, everybody's going to want it back because you need it to stay.
Okay. If they're not all like labeled.
As long as it's organized, the entire point of looking at it is this useful to a future?
Oh, yeah, definitely.
So if it's useful to a future, you can.
Yeah.
Okay, I got it. Just, you know, quick informal poll, those remaining. How many here have used cross products before? How many here feel comfortable with cross products? Okay. How many here know the left-handed rule? Ah, you're lying right now. There's a right-handed rule. Right, exactly. Left hand you can use for like electron currents and EM or something like that if you've got negatively charged things. How many of you here don't know what a cross product is? Okay, that's fine. So I'll have to go into cross products a bit because torques are an excellent introduction to cross products. We've used dot products for work. We use cross products for torque. We use dot and cross products for EM. Rotational force or lack thereof. Use the rotational force, Luke. Okay, so may as well. Here, so we got here's another example problem from the book that I just pulled out because I like the little picture. You got an elevator, you got a disc rotating. This is one of those examples of a problem where you have to intraconvert between linear and rotational motion. So really it's all about dividing by R or multiplying by R depending on what you're trying to do. So you've got this elevator with a disc on top, and it's got a counterweight against the elevator, and it's going to rotate and lift the elevator up and down. And the disc is 2.5 meters in diameter. So I should write down R equals 1.25 meters. Again, one of those gotchas where it says diameter and you have to be careful. And the question is now, how does this thing have to turn to do various linear things? Whoops, to the elevator.
Oh no.
There we go. How many RPMs does it have to go to move the elevator a certain speed? How does it have to angularly accelerate to linearly accelerate the elevator? And how far does it have to go? So I moved all of these onto, you know, a board here. And wrote down shorthand versions of these items. And this is, you know, problem 9.18, so it's a little ways into the chapter. But given that the radius is 1.5 meters, remember the diameter was 2.5 meters. That's kind of the only gotcha you have, because everything else is really applications of S is equal to R times theta, of distance, velocity is equal to R times omega, and acceleration is equal to R times alpha, right? Those three concepts really have to play out here. So for part A, it's asking what's omega given the velocity, the elevator moving at 25 centimeters per second. Well, if this thing is turning, certainly the speed with which the cable is moving is also the speed that the elevator is moving up and down. So I just use omega is equal to V over R. Make sure that you convert your units. Some people did not get centimeters and meters straight during the midterm. Okay, and this is going to be, this is 1/5, right? 25 over 125 is 1/5. So this is 0.2 radians per second. And you can see that here is another kind of classic example of, what was that? 0.1, oh, 0.25 over 125 is 1/5, right? This is 0.2. So, and notice that this ended up being something per second, but I stuck in the radians. Radians are a non-unit unit. Part B, I mean, everything else is basically exactly the same thing, right? Alpha is equal to A over R. The acceleration is 1/8 of a G, so it'll be something like 9.8 meters per second squared times 1/8. Divide that by the 1.25 meters. And you end up getting some number out here. And you'll end up getting that number in radians per second squared. And for part C, the same thing applies. Theta is equal to S over R. How far did I move? I had to rotate this cable on here that amount, 3.25 meters, so S had to be 3.25 meters divided by 1.25 meters. And this thing ends up being, what, 12 plus this ends up being 14 over 4 times that, 14 over 6, 7/3 radians. Right, 13. Sorry. Trying to do the math in my head. Right, double this is 6.5, double that again is 13. Double this again, double this is 2.5, double it again is 5. Relatively simple applications, but this is kind of stuff that you'll be doing in your homework. And then you can start asking questions about, okay, if I turn this thing how many times, how many floors do I go up and down? You can apply all the kinematics you want to it to get more and more complicated. So far, so good. So let's briefly get into torque, and I'll explain my own version, at least, of the cross product as well. So just like acceleration, velocity, position, all of those of angular versions, well, we're going to get into F equals ma. We're going to want to apply Newton to rotating systems. Except now, it's not A anymore, right? F equals MA is now, it's something equals something times alpha, whereas that's an angular acceleration, and I have an angular force trying to make something rotate, and I have something like an angular mass trying to keep me from rotating it. So I'm going to have to figure out some analogs to these things, and that's going to end up being a little bit harder than Newton. It is not just simply dividing by radius anymore. So the corresponding force analog, the turning of something, is called torque. Those of you that are gearheads are familiar with it. It depends on the rotational axis. Just like angular acceleration, angular velocity, all of those depend on where you're turning to. So if I'm pushing something around and making it turn, certainly torque is going to depend on radius, just like all my other rotational things do. Remember, force was a vector, just like angular acceleration. Acceleration was a vector, right? Turns out that angular acceleration is actually also a vector, and torque is actually also a vector. And the mass analog, something called moment of inertia, is not a vector. Just like regular mass is not a vector. So let's back off of this for a second, and let me point out something that was not evident in the slides earlier. And this is the connection. So let's say that this thing is rotating around. This is something moving actually in a circle because I've got it in space. So this is rotational motion in a circle with angular acceleration. Alpha. Okay? So let's say I've got this thing and I'm moving it around and it's actually accelerating around in that direction. Now, remember that complicated picture I had where I had the radial acceleration pointing in and the tangential acceleration pointing around the circle? Turns out that angular acceleration is a vector. And it doesn't point in either one of those directions. In fact, it points perpendicular to both of them. And angular acceleration, in this case, would point up out of the plane of that circle. Perpendicular to the plane of the circle. And the direction because I could point perpendicular up or perpendicular down, the direction is given by the right-hand rule. Okay? So that acceleration, if that angular acceleration is turning around in that direction, I just drew that angular acceleration vector pointing up like that. If it were decelerating, or if it were accelerating in the clockwise direction, the angular acceleration vector would point down. Okay? We're getting into the wonderful, lovely realm of real three-dimensional vector approaches to all of these things. But angular acceleration is a vector, just like regular acceleration is a vector, except now it's this complicated vector that depends on the spin and this right-hand rule. Why is that so useful? It's so useful because when we get back into torque, okay, what torque is, just like F equals ma, torque is now also something a little complicated. Torque is defined as a relationship of the force to the radius that it's trying to turn around. Remember, just like everything else in angular terms, there's a radius involved. But now I need to get a vector out of a radius, which is a vector, and a force, which is a vector. And the way that you multiply two vectors together and get a vector is called the cross product. And it's mathematically, that's just the way that you multiply two vectors together and get a third vector. I'm going to go over cross products real quick and then connect it to why torque is relevant for angular acceleration and how this connects back to Newton's laws. So I've got written on that slide this magic formula, torque is equal to R cross F. Okay. And what is a cross product? A cross product when you take a cross product between two vectors, let's say this is A and this is B, and then A cross B is going to equal A times B times the sine of the angle in between them. Okay. And it points according to the right-hand rule. And it's perpendicular to both A and B. So a cross product takes a vector times a vector and gives you a vector. And the vector that the cross product gives you is always perpendicular to the vectors that you're multiplying, that you're taking the cross product of. So here in this case, A cross B points kind of out of the board at you. The right hand rule means everybody has a different way of doing this. I do it this way because it's a little story, it's a little narrative. Point your fingers in the direction of the first one, curl them in the direction of the second one, because this thing is actually called a curl. Del cross something is called the curl. A curled into B, and then the way your thumb is pointing is the direction of the final vector. And you notice I'm using my right hand. Okay? The way cross B points out of the board here. That's all there is to it. There are different ways that you can actually calculate this out using all of the components of A and B. But generally it's easiest just to say the length of this vector is A times B times the sine of the angle between them. And use the right hand rule to figure things out. So if A and B point with each other, what's the cross product? Zero. Okay. Because the angle in between them is zero. And if A and B are perpendicular to each other, A cross B is kind of maximum. Since theta is 90 degrees, right? And the sine of 90 is a maximum. And another thing that you can notice if you play around with this a little bit is that A cross B is equal to minus B cross A. So don't screw up the order. Because if you screw up the order, you get the sign wrong. That's why it's torque is equal to R cross F and not torque is equal to F cross R. But you're going to see an easy way to remember that in a second. Okay? So far, so good. This is your introduction to cross products. You'll use cross products a lot more in Calc 3, and you'll use cross products a lot more next semester in E&M. So let me go into this connection real quick, and then we'll be done for the day. And we'll probably review it again on Wednesday because this is the way things work. But remember I said torque is equal to R cross F. And remember that angular acceleration is a vector. And it's a vector perpendicular to the plane of the circle. Does this make sense? Okay, so let's say we have something here. We have a radius. Now I'm going to apply a force through that radius. I'm going to take this turnstile or this circular thing, whatever it is, and I'm going to make it rotate. I'm going to make it turn in this direction, and I'm going to angularly accelerate it. So I'm applying a force through a radius. I am applying a torque. And here, the angle is 90 degrees. So the torque is equal to F times R. I should write R times F, just to be consistent with that. R times F. And the sine of the angle in between them, which is just R times F. R cross F points up. So the torque points up. So the torque points out of the board. Remember the angular acceleration also followed this right-hand rule. And so the angular acceleration produced by that torque is also pointing up and out of the board. If I define torque this way, R cross F, that torque and that angular acceleration point in the same direction. That torque produces that angular acceleration, F equals ma. And all we have to do is figure out what exactly it means to have rotational mass, which is moment of inertia, which we'll get to next class. Okay? But this definition of torque relates directly to all the vector aspects of alpha and angular acceleration. So on Wednesday, you'll get exams back. We'll review a little bit maybe, and we'll go from there.